We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is Focus 580. Good morning, I'm Bill Hammack. Today I'm looking at an ancient clockwork called the Antikythera mechanism. It may well have been the world's first computer. Arthur C. Clarke, the great science fiction writer, valued this device so highly that he thought the Industrial Revolution might have started more than 1,000 years ago. By now, he said, we would not merely be potting around on the moon, we would have reached the nearest stars. Our guest today wrote the book Decoding the Heavens, subtitled A 2,000-Year-Old Computer and the Century-Long Search to Discover Its Secret. It's a fascinating book that reads like a thriller. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Also, keep in mind that you can listen to WILL Live online. And if you like, send me a question today via Twitter. It's at EngineerGuyTwit. That's all one word, EngineerGuyTwit. And I'll read them on the air. Let's welcome to Focus 580, Joe Marchant.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Hi, Joe. So let's just start with what this Antikythera mechanism looks like. If a listener wanted to see it, where would they go and what would they see?
Well, the remains of it are held in the National Archaeological Museum in Athens in Greece. But it's kind of interesting to look at that. It was under the sea for 2,000 years, sank on a shipwreck around the beginning of the 1st century BC. So if you go and see it now, it's in pieces, it's green, it's battered, it's covered in sort of accretion products from being under the water, it's corroded. So it doesn't really look very much like the original.
And so is there anywhere they could see a reproduction? Do they have to go to this National Archaeological Museum in Athens?
There is a reproduction alongside it in that museum. And there are some other models around the place. One place that you can look on the web. I have a website, actually, where there is a video of one of the people who's made a beautiful reconstruction of it. So you can have a look there. It's decodingtheheavens.com. Otherwise, in terms of seeing them in museums, Athens is probably the best place to go.
Mm-hmm. And from what I can understand, that what we're looking at is 82 fragments, seven of them very, very large and 75 are smaller. And we want to look a little bit at the story of how they piece together what this does. But why don't we start with how it was discovered? Who first discovered this and what were they actually looking for?
Yeah, there's quite a story here. It was a group of sponge divers. This is back in 1900, when diving for sponges was a booming industry in the Mediterranean. And there was a group of these divers in a tiny little boat. They were sailing from their diving grounds off the coast of North Africa, where they'd been for the whole summer, sailing home to Sumy, which is one of the islands in the Aegean Sea in the eastern Mediterranean, which is where they came from. And they were blown, of course, by a storm. And found shelter in a little cove in this tiny island called Antikythera. And then once the storm had abated, one of them dived down to look for whether it was seafood for their dinner or more sponges, we're not sure, but he came back up again just a few minutes later, sort of coughing and spluttering, desperate to get out of his suit. And basically he was gabbling about having seen a pile of dead naked women on the seabed. He was terrified. So the captain of the boat went down himself to have a look and realized that it wasn't a pile of dead people. It was a pile of statues. This was actually ancient treasure from a shipwreck that had sunk thousands of years earlier. And they were then hired by the Greek government to salvage the treasures from this wreck. Most of it was bronze and marble statues. There was jewelry, a bronze throne, other furniture, weapons, this kind of thing. It was an incredible haul. But there was one thing that came up, which was just looked like a battered rock and was just left in a crate in a courtyard. Nobody really thought very much of it until a few months later when it cracked open.
So, of course, that's the mechanism. But one of the interesting things you tell in this story, though, is I think readers should know that there's a fascinating story about this mechanism, but you also reveal a lot of other kinds of science. And if they like science, they would enjoy this. For example, those divers, how did they do this? Were they scuba suits? Did they have compression suits? Were they free divers? Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, so as I said, this is 1900. And so they were diving in sort of big, heavy canvas diving suits with rubber seals and then a huge bronze helmet on the top. And they breathed compressed air through a tube that ran up to a compressor in the boat above. So for thousands of years, Greeks had made a living diving for sponges in the Mediterranean, and for, you know, since Homer's time, and they had been diving naked, weighed down by a stone, and then gathering what they could. And it was just a few decades before this, in the 1860s, when these big suits had come in. But what they didn't realize when they started doing this is if you breathe compressed air underwater, when you come up, you're going to suffer from the bends. And this killed tens of thousands of divers in the subsequent decades. So it was very dangerous what they were doing at this time. And this, the wreck was about 60 meters down as well. So it was really an incredible achievement to be diving there at all, let alone hauling up, you know, these heavy statues.
Mm-hmm. So there was there a loss of human life from this, or was there injury to get this back?
Yes. So it took about 10 months in all to salvage the wreck. And there were around 12 divers, I think. And out of those, one of them died of the bends, and two of them were permanently paralyzed. So it was really a huge sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. So they brought up this chunk of corroded, you know, green box, as you said, along with a lot of bronzes and statues and things. And I assume that the curators of the National Museum in Greece were amazed by this clockwork at first. Is that what they looked at first? What did they think of it?
Yeah, so as I said, it had been pretty much ignored for months. And then they suddenly, when it cracked open, they saw traces of gear wheels, and it was covered in inscriptions, and it was like nothing they'd seen before. So, yeah, it caused a huge excitement at the museum because they knew it was ancient Greek. They knew how old it was, and the Greeks shouldn't have had anything like that. It looked like a sort of clockwork mechanism. There were dials and pointers, so it looked as if the gear wheels were being used to make certain calculations. And, you know, as far as we know otherwise, the Greeks didn't have clockwork. No other gear wheels like this are known from the ancient world. Not a single wheel, and it's still not a single wheel has been found. No other sort of example of an accurate measuring scale. So it was completely unique, and they called in experts from all over Europe to come and have a look at this thing.
So there's quite a mystery about what this did, and let's kind of work our way through some of the ways that they salvaged it. So who was the first people at the museum to look at this device, and what was their interpretation of what it did? Albeit wrong, but what was their interpretation?
Well, there was a range. There was a couple of scholars there. There was a particular Greek scholar who thought it was some kind of astrolabe. So an astrolabe, we don't really use them anymore, but they were popular in medieval times. It's like one sort of disc of metal that rotates over another, and it simulates the movements of the sun, moon, and stars in the sky. It's kind of a very simple kind of astronomical calculator, if you like. But it didn't really fit because they don't need any gear wheels. It's just one disc that rotates over another. And there were others that thought that perhaps it was a hoax, or that perhaps it was a much more modern instrument that had been dropped on the wreck site later by chance. One guy thought, you know, it must be a modern clock that had just been dropped. So it was a whole range of things. You know, nobody really knew what to make of it. And, you know, the pieces were so battered that it was really difficult to tell very much from them at all.
So to kind of look at their first reaction, the first reaction was, if this is ancient, it can't be anything very complicated. So it's got to be something relatively simple to us, like an astrolabe, right? So what are the kind of things they did then to date that, to determine in context where it was from, what islands it was going from? What kind of things did they look at from the ship?
Well, there wasn't much they could do with the pieces themselves. You know, they could barely make out a few words of the inscriptions, but they could tell it was Greek and it was ancient Greek, so that fitted. In terms of the ship, they were looking at the statues that had come back, but some of those dated back to the 5th century BC. You know, they could clearly have been very old at the time that they were put onto the ship. So again, it didn't really, there was a lot of argument about exactly how old this thing was. I mean, really, marine archaeology didn't exist as a field at this time. This is actually the first wreck ever to be salvaged by archaeologists. So they were really groping around in the dark. And they kind of worked out that, I mean, they knew it was a Roman ship, not a Greek ship. And they knew that it sailed probably from the eastern Mediterranean to the west. So it looked as though, and the statues also had traces of lead where they had once been attached to their bases. So they kind of formed the theory that this, you know, these had been ripped down in a hurry, and perhaps the treasures were stolen Greek items that the Romans had taken and were shipping back home to Rome.
So let's go ahead and take a look at how they kind of place this in context. I mean, was there things like coins and luxury goods and other things on that ship that helped them date it?
At the time, they mostly looked at the statues, but since then there have been sort of other archaeologists have been looking at the wreck, you know, as this field of scholarship has progressed. And also Jacques Cousteau went back to the wreck site in the 1970s with a team of divers. So first of all, you had people looking at the everyday items on the ship, so the pots and plates and things like that, which you can be relatively sure, because they wouldn't have lasted very long, if you can date those, that gives you a much more accurate date for the ship itself, rather than things like statues, which could have been antiques when they were put onto the ship. And they started to pin it down to probably the beginning of the first century BC. And then what Jacques Cousteau found, I mean, he found a range of other things, but specifically he found some silver and bronze coins. And these came from Pergamon and Ephesus, which were cities on the Asia Minor coast, so confirming that that's where the ship probably came from. And they had dates on them between 70 and 60 BC. So that's really what has pinned down the date of the wreck most precisely.
So this is Bill Hammack, and I'm visiting with the author Joe Marchant, and we're talking about the Anthocathero mechanism, an ancient Greek clockwork that might well have been the world's first computer. So I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL, or if you're anywhere in the area, you can call at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455, or you can send a question on Twitter, Engineer Guy Twit, all one word. So one of the most interesting stories that you told in there was you revealed the texture by which scholars date things, how they very carefully do their archaeological work. And you talked about Miss Grace, who was an expert on vases. How did that help date this this device?
Yeah, she was Virginia Grace, her name was, mm-hmm. and this was in the 1960s. And she was pretty much the world expert on amphoras, which was basically a sort of pottery jar or vase, mm-hmm. with a pointed bottom, and they had handles around the neck, and they were used for storing all kinds of items, mainly sort of food related grains, olive oil, fish, that kind of thing, and basically the style and the shape of these as they were made in the Greek and Roman world changed over time. So you could have a look at the shape of the handles or the length of the neck and this kind of thing, and she would be able to tell from that, because she has studied thousands and thousands of these things, exactly where in the Mediterranean these jars came from, and pin it down to particular times as well. The other thing you could look at is the sort of the level in the ground where these things came out of, and you tended to, you know, you can see, for example, you can see great events of destruction and also times of rebuilding, because you get the kind of remains of all of those items left in the ground. There's a very distinct layer. So in Athens, there was a Roman general called Sulla who destroyed the city in kind of just a couple of days, and you can still see all the broken pottery and different things that stay there. So you can kind of get a sense of the timing from that as well. So she looked at the jars from the Antikythera ship, and she was able to pin them down to Asia Minor, but also to Rhodes and a couple of other islands in the Eastern Mediterranean. So again, supporting the idea that this is where the ship had come from, and quite likely to stop off in Rhodes, actually, which was a major trading post at the time.
So so tell us a little bit about Rhodes and where that ship would have been going back and forth. What would it have been doing?
So Rhodes, as I said, because of its location, it was a major trading post. So everybody would have stopped off there. So there would have been ships crisscrossing backwards and forwards the Mediterranean, east to west, down to Alexandria and Egypt as well, bringing grain, bringing glassware, all kinds of different goods that were being traded in. And Rhodes had this sort of central position where everybody would have stopped off there. They made a fortune, actually, the Rhodians, from taxes, from allowing people to moor their ships there. So it seems pretty clear that this particular ship had set off from the east, from the Asia Minor coast, so what would now be Turkey, mm-hmm. And had sailed south down the coast and then set off going west. So it would have stopped off at Rhodes and then carried on going west, actually sank at Antikythera, but if it hadn't have sunk there, it would have carried on round probably the bottom of Italy and up to Rome, because the Romans, they just shipped huge amounts of goods from the Greek colonies in Asia Minor back home to Rome, either sort of as they were sort of sweeping through and basically taking over this whole area. They just stole all the goods they could find and shipped back anything that they fancied. But also afterwards, they were extracting huge amounts of taxes as well. So there were just fleets and fleets, hundreds and hundreds of ships were going east to west, carrying all these Greek items back to Rome.
Mm-hmm. So let's now begin to look a little bit at how they solved what this mechanism does. In the book, you spend quite a bit of time talking about the very interesting character, Derek de Sola Price. He's a mm-hmm. famous historian of science and technology. And he spent a lot of time counting the teeth in the gears. Can you tell me a little bit about what he thought this was and how he moved along the investigation into its use?
Yeah, so we studied the mechanism from, he started in the 1950s until the 1970s. He was British, but he was working at Yale as a mm-hmm. professor of history of science there. And he really became obsessed with this thing. I mean, he was very interested in the history of technology, really, where the first scientific instruments came from. And in particular, astronomical instruments. And he found out about this thing, which at the time was languishing in Athens, and nobody was really paying much attention to it, because after this first burst of excitement when it was first discovered, nobody could really work out what it was, so it kind of just got forgotten about. And so he spent, you know, maybe 20 years studying this thing. And he started off doing what had been done before, looking at the traces of gear wheels on the outside, trying to read the inscriptions. But the breakthrough he made was that he was able to use X-ray technology to image the fragments and actually look inside them. And then he could see many more gear wheels hidden inside and really get to grips with the mechanism and try and work out what it was doing. And the reason he wanted to count the teeth on the gears is because you can use gear wheels, but it's like clockwork inside a clock. If one gear wheel is driving another, you can use that to carry out mathematical calculations. So if you have a gear wheel, say, with 20 teeth, and it drives a second gear wheel with 10 teeth, then every time you turn your first gear wheel, your second gear wheel is going to turn twice. So in effect, you've multiplied your input one turn by two. Your output is two turns. Mm-hmm. And so by building up gear wheels in that way, you can get more and more sophisticated calculations going on. So by counting the teeth, he wanted to know, what's the maths behind this? What's actually being calculated inside? And he worked out, he got quite a lot wrong about the mechanism, and there was lots that he didn't get, but the key thing that he got was that it was actually calculating the motions of the sun and the moon in the sky. So you would would have been a wooden, housed in a wooden case, a bit like mm-hmm. a clock you might have on your mantelpiece, about that size as well. And by turning a handle on the side, you would activate the gear wheels inside, and there was a big dial on the front, and you would have had pointers. And as you turned it, it was like winding forwards or backwards in time. So initially, it was driving a pointer that would have gone around the dial once in a year, and you had scales around the edge showing you the months of the year and the signs of the zodiac, and that would have been the movement of the sun. And then you had gear wheels that then converted that into the speed of the moon. So you had a second pointer that was showing you the speed of the moon. And that was kind of the heart of it. There's all kinds of other stuff going on as well, but he really got the essence of this thing, which is that he called it a calendar computer. So it's a device that is calculating the movement of astronomical bodies through mm-hmm. the sky.
So de Sola Price led people at least in the direction, if he missed some of the details inside, he led in the direction that it was a calendar. How did the Greeks think about the heavens, and how did they think about the motions of the planet? Why would they want such a thing?
Yeah, those are quite big questions. So first of all, they were really interested in the geometry of the heavens. You know, how is everything arranged? How is everything moving around? So that's in contrast, say, to the Babylonians who came before them, who thought of the sky as pretty much flat, and then they sort of watched things moving around as if on a flat canvas, whereas the Greeks were thinking in 3D, and they wanted to know kind of what was revolving around what. But they thought of everything in terms of perfect circles. So for them, you know, the heavens were divine, and so things could only have moved in perfect circles because, you know, well, circles are perfect, and that was what you'd expect something divine to be. They couldn't comprehend any kind of irregularity in the way that things in the sky moved. So they had to explain what they were seeing in terms of perfect circles. So, you know, it's quite famous that they came up with the idea of epicycles for the movements of the planets. Mm-hmm. You know, we look at the planets, and they're not because they're not revolving around the Earth, they're revolving around the Sun like we are.
Sure.
They don't move in a nice constant speed through the sky as we're looking at them. And now we know why that is. But because they thought that the planets were revolving around the Earth, they came up with this idea of epicycles, which is almost as if, you know, they thought the planets were looping the loop, going in little circles at the same time as they went around us in big circles. And that was how they were able to explain this irregular motion of the planets. And that's the kind of theory that we see encoded in the Antikythera mechanism. So Derek Price realized that it was calculating the Sun and the Moon, and what we now know is that it was almost certainly calculating the movements of the planets as well, and it incorporated these epicyclic theories that they had.
So keeping in mind that the orbit of the planets and orbits of the Moon and the Sun are not completely circular, that made this mechanism very difficult to build and very difficult to decipher. And one of the people that really moved it forward was a curator at the Science Museum called Michael Wright. And what was his contribution to this? And tell us a little bit about him also.
Yeah, so he's retired now, but for many years he was a curator at the Science Museum in London. And he's a technician. I mean, he builds instruments by hand using traditional techniques. His workshop is amazing. It's kind of it's just absolutely crammed full of all sorts of different mechanisms and devices and things that he's made, and 17th century lathes and different instruments and that kind of thing. And he was very interested in astronomical clocks and geared mechanisms. So that's how he got interested in the Antikythera mechanism. And whereas Derek Price came at this from a history of science point of view, Michael Wright wanted to know the kind of the guts of how did this thing work? How did these gears fit together? And for him, that was the driving force of wanting to solve exactly what this thing did. He'd seen Price's work and realized that there were things missing, things that Price hadn't realized. And so Michael Wright also went to Athens, also x-rayed the fragments again, but he actually built a crude device that enabled him to do tomography. This was in the 1990s, which is where you x-ray them, but you can actually separate out different layers inside the fragments. So rather than all of the gear wheels appearing in your x-ray images on top of each other, he's getting a sort of more of a sense of what's at the top, what's at the bottom, how these things are arranged.
So let's pause and be sure that tomography is clear here, because that's a really important concept. So
Okay. They
have this large chunk of you know, green corroded metal. They need to look inside it. And as I understand it, what you do is you take x-rays, but you slowly rotate the object. So essentially, you're able to look at slices. Is that correct?
Yes, basically. I mean, it's used a lot in medicine, sort of imaging tumors and that kind of thing now. But at the time, Michael Wright, he built a cradle, basically. So he had a big x-ray source that was fixed. And then he built a cradle in which he put the fragment he wanted to image and then the film. And he swung it as he was taking the exposure. And the sort of swings in an arc. And the effect of that is that most of the planes of the image, of the fragment that you're imaging, come out as blurred, but there's one plane, sort of one level within that fragment that comes out as sharp focus. So you end up with kind of a very streaky, blurry image, but there will be one level that you can actually see the detail of. So it's quite difficult to interpret the images, but if you know what you're doing, you can then focus at sort of different subsequent levels and get a sense of which gear wheels are at the top, which ones at the bottom, which ones are at the same level and therefore likely to be engaging with each other.
This is Focus 580, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Joe Marchant, author of Decoding the Heavens, a 2,000-year-old computer and the century-long search to discover its secrets. I invite you to call with questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or use Twitter, Engineer Guy Twit, all one word, and I'll read your questions on the air. So an interesting aspect of the Michael Wright story is that you show the texture of how scholars work. You kind of open up their world, and it's not always a pretty world. He partnered with Professor Bromley from Australia. They together did the x-rays and the tomography. Tell us a little bit about what happened. What were the tensions between the two of them?
They started off as good friends. So Alan Bromley was also very interested in the history of computing, in particular Charles Babbage. And so he was based at the University of Sydney but came over to the Science Museum in London because they held all of Babbage's papers, so he was overstudying those. And because they sort of shared this interest in these old mechanisms, they would end up chatting together. And both got interested in the Antikythera mechanism. Alan Bromley, he sadly died in 2002 of cancer, so he's not around to tell his side of the story. Mm-hmm. But the way that Michael Wright tells it is that he really wanted to study the Antikythera mechanism, but as a curator, he had a staff position at the Science Museum. It wasn't really his place to go and do that. So what ended up happening was that Alan Bromley got permission from the Athens Museum to go and study the fragments, and then Michael came along almost as his assistant. I think there was some disagreement as whether he was Bromley's assistant or whether they were equal partners. They kind of saw that differently. And so they took all of these images. They took hundreds and hundreds of X-ray images. And then at the end of it all, it took them years to do this. Bromley took all of the images back to Sydney, leaving Michael Wright distraught because he'd put years into this and then had to go back home to London without any of his precious hard-won images. So that's kind of where it all started to go wrong. And then Bromley fell ill, hadn't really told a lot of people around him the fact that that was happening. So, you know, communication is drying up. Meanwhile, Michael Wright's in London. So it all sorts of starts to really spiral from there. And it wasn't until after Bromley's death that Michael Wright got a lot of those images back and was able to restart his studies.
Well, take a look at what Michael Wright did in just a minute. But I'm going to go ahead and take a caller on line one from Urbana, Illinois. So caller on line one, please go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The device was recovered intact, essentially, except for the wooden case?
It's not. We don't have all of it. So it's in pieces. There are three main pieces and then lots and lots of smaller pieces. And there are fragments of the wood, but most of the wood has gone. But what does seem to be clear, I mean, you can fit the pieces that we have together and make most of the mechanism, but it seems clear that there was more gear work on the front that we don't have, and that is what Michael Wright is fairly certain would have modelled the planets. And most people have agreed that that was there and probably did model the planets, but that doesn't survive today. And it may be that there are, perhaps there was other stuff there as well that we don't have, which is either still at the bottom of the sea, or perhaps it's still hidden in the storeroom at the Athens Museum somewhere. New pieces of the mechanism do seem to come to light every few years when people do further searches of those storerooms.
Joe, we're going to take another call. This call is from Belgium. I assume it's Belgium, the country. Hello, caller from Belgium?
No, this is Belgium, the village.
I wondered. It just pops up on my screen, and that's good enough. Go ahead.
Yeah. The question I have is not really so much about the mechanism, as it is about some of the things you've said earlier about, and one of the things that caught me the most about the things you said earlier is that today we seem to think that the people before us were not capable of doing some very remarkable things, especially when it comes to technology. Well, there obviously this piece exists, so therefore there must have been probably at least one more, because the guy probably made a model, if nothing else. And that means it was lost in time. So maybe many, many things that have been very intricate and unusual have just been recycled by either human beings or Mother Nature, and we'll never know how exactly technologically advanced previous people were.
Well, Joe, let's go ahead and follow up on that a little bit. Since this was made of bronze, was this metal more useful in it just, you know, as metal itself than as an object? Is that what happened eventually to some of these?
Over time, yeah. I mean, I completely agree with the caller's comment. We don't know everything that the Greeks or other ancient civilizations were able to do because so little survives. And yes, especially things made of bronze. You know, when this thing was made, this kind of device probably would have been highly prized. But as time went on, and especially with the collapse of the Roman Empire, when, you know, everything collapsed, basically, and this kind of sort of high-tech device wouldn't have been, you know, the learning was lost. It wouldn't have been seen as important, but the bronze would have been seen as valuable and would inevitably have been melted down and recycled. So this kind of item just does not survive from ancient times. It's only when you get them, you know, the fact that it was sunk on a shipwreck and is out of reach at the bottom of the sea, that we see this kind of thing. And you can see how little survives if you look at bronze statues, for example. So we know from ancient writings that there were hundreds of thousands, probably, of bronze statues decorating the streets of Greek cities all over the Mediterranean. And now one of the biggest collections of those statues is in the National Archaeological Museum in Athens, and they have just 10, and all but one of those are from shipwrecks. So if you just look at the numbers there, the ratio of what existed then compared to what survives now, you can see that if we have just one Antikythera mechanism, then, you know, just from the stats, there must have been many more than that. If there'd only ever been one originally, the chances of us having found that one would be, you know, would be tiny. You can also look at how sophisticated the mechanism is. It's very small, for example. And you couldn't have made this as a one-off, as the caller said.
Right.
And,
right.
And you would have. This probably would have developed over generations as they built up their skills gradually.
So I want to return toward the end of the interview to kind of the meaning of this and whether there were more, but maybe we ought to be sure that we solve at least part of the mystery for the listeners of what it is. Where we were was Michael Wright from the British Science Museum had really built on Derek de Solla Price's studies and said this is a planetarium. You can model the sun, the moon, but also the planets like Mercury and Venus and the superior planets like Mars and Jupiter and Saturn. And actually built some models. But the next people to really begin to tackle this were a little bit what I think is an oddball couple, two named Mike Edmonds and Tony Freeth, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
What are their backgrounds and how did they get involved in this?
So Mike Edmonds is a professor of astronomy at Cardiff University in the UK. And he came across the mechanism because he was looking for just a cute project for one of his students, a cute history project, something that they could have a look into, write up a paper on. And he came across the Antikythera mechanism, thought, oh, this is intriguing. And Tony Freeth was an old friend of his, basically. He lives in London. He was a filmmaker, made science documentaries, and mentioned it to him one time and said, oh, Tony, you know, this would be a great subject for one of your films. And so the two of them ended up getting together. Basically, Tony Freeth wanted to make a film but realized that that there weren't really enough answers to make a film. You needed new results. You needed to know what this thing was really to make a satisfying documentary. So the two of them got together and then took other people into their team as appropriate and decided that they were going to solve the mechanism. And it became, in the end, almost less about the film and more about actually wanting to solve the thing.
So let's look at some of the difficulties that they ran into and then look at what their solution was, because it's rather fascinating what this actually did. First of all, Michael Wright was working on it, and he had permission from the museum to film it and to work with his X-rays. Does a museum typically then allow another set simultaneously to work on the mechanism, or do they have to wait until somebody like Michael Wright is done?
Yes, so generally what happens with these archaeological artifacts, because I think a lot of them are very fragile, you don't want them to be studied by too many people at once, so generally once somebody is working on something, you would let that person finish their work and publish, and then somebody else can come in and have a look at it. But Michael Wright had been working on it for many, many years, partly because of the problems that he'd had with his collaborator, and just the technical difficulties with interpreting the X-ray images and that kind of thing. So this new group decided that they didn't want to wait for Michael Wright to finish. As far as they could see, there wasn't very much progress happening there. So they took some high-profile Greek scientists on board into their team and basically lobbied the Greek government until eventually they won permission to study the fragments for themselves.
And what techniques did they bring to it that were different than what had been done before?
So whereas Michael was working in his workshop at home, he'd handmade this cradle for tomography. It was all kind of low tech, just using his own ingenuity, hand making his models. This team wanted to throw the best, most advanced technology they could at it. So Tony Freeth started looking around for what can we use to make sure that we get more information than ever before out of the images that we take. And he worked with one X-ray imaging company based in the UK called X-Tech, and they specialize in 3D X-ray computing tomography, which is a much higher tech version of what Michael Wright was doing. So very high-powered X-rays, very fine, high-resolution images that you're getting. And it takes images from lots and lots of different angles, hundreds of different directions, and then when you feed all of that information into a computer, it can build up a 3D simulation of the whole insides of the fragment that you're looking at. And that they actually had to develop a whole new machine just for the Antikythera mechanism because nothing that they had already was powerful enough because these fragments are made of bronze and very dense, and to be able to get through the thickest you know, the direction to get through it lengthways as well as widthways, you needed a very high-powered machine. So that was one thing that they did. And they also worked with researchers from Hewlett-Packard in California and used some of their imaging technology where you take images of something lit from lots and lots of different directions. Again, you feed that into a computer and you can simulate your object in the computer, and then you can get the computer to light it from any direction that you want, change the reflectance properties of your object, that kind of thing. And that, they used that for reading the inscriptions better than ever had been before, to get a better view of the lettering.
So we have an astronomer now, and we have a filmmaker who also, I believe, is a mathematician, and they've got a very powerful high-resolution technique, allows them to read the letters in there. What is it that they found that this, how this mechanism worked, and what did they find that it actually did? What was their conclusion?
So they were able to solve some problems that Michael Wright hadn't been able to. So he really got very close to getting what was happening in the mechanism. You had the sun, you had the moon, you had the planets, and also he realized that it wasn't just, you know, constant rates of motion that were being calculated. It was this sort of epicyclic varying motion, which takes very sophisticated gear trains. But what the new team were able to do, both from looking at the details of the gear wheels, but also the inscriptions that they were now able to read, was they realized that it's also predicting eclipses. So there was a spiral dial on the back of the mechanism, which was divided into 223, and they realized that this is 223 months, which is around 18 years, and this was what's called, or the Greeks called, the Saros cycle. Eclipses tend to repeat themselves every 223 months. So you had this dial, and as you turn the handle, the pointer would move around, and in these month segments, you would have marked which month you expected to see a lunar eclipse or a solar eclipse, and also lots of information about the type of eclipse, the timing, the location, the duration, that kind of thing. So that really added a whole new dimension to what this device was doing.
So they looked at this, they found this four-year cycle, the four segments for 1 year. What is it that they thought that a person who used this would be doing with it? What is it they would be measuring?
There are different theories about that. I mean, one is that it could have been an astrological device for casting horoscopes. So astrology was just becoming very popular in Greece at the time. And, you know, this would have been perfect if you could wind backwards or forwards to any point in time, so somebody's time of birth, for example, and this would tell you everything that was happening in the sky at that particular time, the position of the sun, the moon, the planets, whether there was an eclipse or not. So for casting a horoscope, absolutely perfect. But there aren't, if you look at the inscriptions, there aren't any astrological references particularly. So that's possible, but maybe not that likely. And what seems more likely is that it was a religious or philosophical demonstration of the workings of the heavens. So there are actually a few mentions in ancient texts, specifically by a writer called Cicero, who was a Roman lawyer at the time, but is also very interested in Greek philosophy. And he made reference to these sort of bronze models of the heavens, and that the reason that he wrote about it was he was saying, you know, you look at this bronze model of the heavens and you can see that it must have been made by sort of somebody intelligent, and therefore when we look at the universe as a whole, surely that's also true. It's kind of an early version of intelligent design, if you like. So there was clearly a lot of religious significance here. And historians hadn't really taken his mention of these devices that seriously. They thought, well, maybe he just made it up to make a point. He hasn't explained how these things would have worked. We've got no other evidence of them. But now we have the Antikythera mechanism, which is just as, you know, as Cicero described. So it seems that he probably was telling the truth after all. And to have something like this that showed you the workings of the heavens, as I said earlier, they saw the heavens as divine, and it would have just been a way to bring you closer to God, closer to the true working and meaning of things, if you like.
Mm-hmm. This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with author Joe Marchant. We're talking about the Antikythera mechanism, an ancient Greek clockwork that might well have been the world's first computer. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL. If you're in the area, if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Or if you have a question on Twitter, you can contact me at EngineerGuyTwit, all one word. So you mentioned that they determined that this was looking at a four-year cycle. Was there any feeling that that four-year cycle had something to do with major events in Greek culture in some way, shape, or form?
Yeah, so this four-year cycle, so that's I was talking about the eclipse cycle, which is 18 years. And then so this was another dial that they was known that was there, but they realized what it was actually doing. And yes, it's divided into the 4 years of the Olympiad, because it's inscribed on this dial are the names of the different Greek games that were held. So the Olympic Games we're all familiar with, but the other games that they held as well, which tended to be either held two-yearly or four-yearly. So by looking at the dial, it would tell you what were the location of the games that was being held in that year. And this was interesting because until then, this was thought of as an astronomical device, you know, perhaps something that would have been used by astronomers, but there's no astronomical significance of whether you've got the Olympic Games or not that year. So that changed the way that this device was viewed, and it's actually got more of a social significance. And what's thought now is that this would have been a demonstration of the workings of the heavens, but it was more of a teaching aid, something to be shown to kind of educated but lay audiences, rather than something that an astronomer would have used to make observations, for example.
So if I understand you correctly, the person who owned this might well have used it to demonstrate the motion of the Earth and the Sun and the planets, and to say, look, this is when the Olympic Games comes up. Is that right? Is it kind of a calendar?
Yeah, I mean, it's like now. I mean, you wouldn't need something like that to tell you when the Olympic Games were coming, because it's only every 4 years you know when the Olympic Games are going to be.
Right.
It was not that you would have needed it, but it was just another nice thing to have on there. And also, when they looked at the month names on one of the calendars on the back, the calendar that was used was not an astronomical calendar. It was a civic calendar that would have been used for sort of normal, everyday events. So again, this is suggesting that this wasn't for use by astronomers, but for lay people. Also, the inscriptions, they look like instructions. They're basically step-by-step how this works with all the different pointers and dials telling you. It's a bit like if you buy a computer today, it'll come with an instruction manual. So it seems that it was made not for use by an astronomer who would have known all the stuff anyway, but perhaps for sale to a rich client who was just, you know, had a lay interest in this kind of thing and perhaps wanted to show it off to his friends at dinner parties, that kind of thing.
So in the book, you actually speculate a little bit about who might have owned this. And one hypothesis is that it was a Stoic philosopher on the Greek island of Rhodes. What's the evidence for that? How do you think about that?
Well, so, yeah, he's a guy called Posidonius, who was one of the most highly respected philosophers in the Greek world. And he lived on Rhodes in the 1st century BC at exactly the time that the ship that carried this mechanism would have sailed. And the reason that he's implicated is mainly because of Cicero, who I mentioned. So when he wrote about this thing, he said, "Our friend Posidonius has made," and then it went on to his description of the mechanism. So we know from that Posidonius either made or was involved in the making of something like this. Whether it was this specific device or not, we don't know. So we know he was making this kind of thing. We know he was on Rhodes, where the ship stopped off, at exactly the time that it would have been there. And also in terms of his philosophy as well, he was very interested in astronomy and the cosmos and its workings, and he didn't think of it in terms of having an intelligent creator, more a kind of divine life force that just infused everything. And so I think something like this that demonstrated the workings of that cosmos would have been very important to him. So it's circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly who made this, exactly who owned it, but there are a lot of clues that point to Posidonius.
Well, let's now look at kind of some of the a little more philosophical questions, or put this in context. We had a fascinating question from a reader that said, look, this may well not have been a one-off device. It's not some kind of tour de force. How many of these do you think were made? What evidence is there that there were more that were made?
I mean, we have no direct evidence, but, you know, as I said, we have a few scattered mentions in text. So it seems.
And mentions of this specifically, or things like this, or
things like, so the same as Cicero would said something along the lines of, you know, a bronze sphere that modeled the workings of the heavens, or showed you the movements of the sun, moon, and planets each day and each night. It was something like that. So it's this kind of thing, and other writers as well wrote sort of similar mentions, and something made by Archimedes that was similar. So it's just hints. You don't know exactly, but hints that there was more than one. Mm-hmm. As I said, in terms of the statistics, you know, if there had only ever been one, you know, it would have been an infinitesimally tiny chance that we would have found that one. Mm-hmm. So there must have been more than that. I mean, presumably there must have been hundreds for us to have a chance really of finding one, because so few of them would have survived. And as I said as well, with the sophistication, that the gearing is so cleverly put together, and certain parts of it are kind of, they've got dual uses, and you've got gear wheels riding around on other gear wheels to model these astronomical equations very accurately. And that's not something you can make as a one-off from scratch. This must have been something that, you know, there was a tradition of these things that was built up over generations. So we can't say exactly how many, but presumably there must have been hundreds of these things being made and shipped across the Greek world, and also being updated to take into account the latest astronomical knowledge, because what we do know about this is it has state-of-the-art astronomical theories within it. So the two, the technicians and the astronomers, must have been working together.
So there's a sense in which there must have been 20, 30, 40, 50 years of developing these. I mean, any engineer that would look at this would think there has to be an evolution of these. So this must have been actually pretty common. Is that what most people who've looked at it think?
Yeah, I mean, not that many people have looked at it closely.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what is quite likely to have happened is you might have started off using gears in a very simple way, so perhaps just constant speeds for the sun and the moon, and then as they develop the epicyclic theory for the planets, and also similar theories were developed to account for the varying speed through the sky as we look at it of the sun and the moon as well. And so as those theories were developed, that could have been incorporated into the gearing. So from going to just very simple gear trains that calculated a constant speed, you could then add in your gear trains riding around on other gears, mm-hmm. to kind of give you those epicycles within the mechanism, and that could have been built up over time. Also, probably the first ones you made would have been much bigger than this, and then they could gradually become miniaturized over time as well.
Mm-hmm. So it points internally, with a little common sense, it points toward an evolution of it. So in this book and in the subtitle, you call it a computer. Should it be called a calculator or a computer? What definition do you use, and did you have to think about that?
I did think about it, yes. I mean, it is controversial. It basically comes down to how you define a computer, and people don't agree on the definition of the word computer. I went to a guy called Doran Swade, who until recently was head of computing at the Science Museum in London. So he was in charge of all of the artifacts there that relate to the history of computing, and basically said to him, what is a computer? And, you know, is the Antikythera mechanism a computer? And his definition was anything that that calculates, you know, a numerical solution to something and then displays that answer on a scale. So something like the Antikythera mechanism, where you've got these gear wheels driving pointers that then show you on a scale kind of where you are, he said he would see that as a computer. Whereas, for example, a bronze model, like a planetarium, if you had like a sort of an Earth in the middle and just some little spherical planets that moved around the outside just to show you how things were arranged, he would not see that as a computer, because there's no kind of number, no particular solution that's being displayed. But other people would disagree with that, and they wouldn't call something a computer unless, you know, it had a keyboard and a monitor and a screen and was exactly the sort of thing that we think of today. So also, for example, one use of the word computer, there used to be, you know, basically women who carried out, you know, who did the math on pieces of paper. So it people do argue about it, but I kind of went to Doran Swade as somebody that I thought was an authority on this, and he said absolutely it's a computer, but not everyone will agree.
So Doran Swade wrote a lovely book on Babbage and how to rebuild the process by which he used to rebuild the computer or build for the first time Babbage's computer.
Mm.
And that's a wonderful book, and I'd just say to listeners that if you enjoyed that book, this book has very much the same character, and I would imagine you would enjoy Decoding the Heavens quite a bit. So in the few minutes that we have left here, we've got about 2 minutes or so. I want to look at the deeper meaning or impact of this mechanism. Was it just a novelty, or was Arthur C. Clarke right to think that building on the knowledge of this, that we would have the Industrial Revolution sooner? I mean, does it tell us something about how technology evolves? So what's the deeper meaning to this?
I think one of the main messages is it just serves as a reminder of how little we know about what they were able to do in the ancient world, and how we shouldn't take them for granted, and how you can't necessarily see technology as a simple, straight progression from the simple to the complicated. And, you know, they weren't able to do very much, and we've been building on that since, and now we can do much cleverer things. It doesn't go like that. There are all kinds of other sort of factors, social factors, economic factors, that play into it, and you can have kind of peaks of technology, and then that knowledge can be lost again. So in one sense, Clark is right that, you know, this was the beginnings of something that could have led to something like the Industrial Revolution. But then on the other hand, it's much more complicated than that. You know, you needed so much else to be in place that wasn't necessarily in place then, which, you know, we weren't really ready for that until much, much later. But it is just a reminder not to take the ancient Greeks for granted.
Mm-hmm. Well, Joe, I want to thank you for taking the time to chat today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Joe Marchant, author of the fascinating book Decoding the Heavens, A 2,000-Year-Old Computer and the Century-Long Search to Discover Its Secret. It's a thrilling work, an enjoyable read, and I believe it's her first book, and we look forward to many more from her. So the technical director of this segment was Henry Frayne, and the producer was Harriet Williamson.